Finally, it would seem that the basic arguments between Miss Carson and her critics transcend the specific pesticide issue, for they involve a conflict of attitude toward man's role in his environment and his attempts to control and manipulate nature for his own benefit.
The fulcrum over which the argument chiefly rests is that Miss Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature, that he has already disrupted the balance of nature by his overburgeoning numbers, his cities and his airports and his roads and the way of his life.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity.
I'm Jean Cecil at the Rachel Carson Homestead, and you are listening to the Allegheny Valley History Podcast. A lot of people are surprised to find out that it is here. We're on the National Registry of Historic Sites, and the claim to fame is that this place is the most significant in Rachel Carson's life. She was born here, upstairs in a bedroom, and she lived here through the time that she went to college. She attended the Pennsylvania College for Women, which is now Chatham, but she spent the most significant portion of her life here.
Welcome to the Allegheny Valley History Podcast, where we explore and showcase topics celebrating the cultural, industrial, and ethnic heritage of the Allegheny River Valley of Western Pennsylvania. This podcast also helps promote local history organizations and museums throughout the Allegheny region in Western Pennsylvania. The Allegheny History Podcast is a production of the Social Voice Project, and it is a member of the Local History Podcast Initiative. I'm your host for this episode, Kevin Farkas, executive producer of the Social Voice Project. Today we have a wonderful episode, right, Janie? I'm sure it's going to be wonderful, right?
I hope so.
Okay.
Counting on you, Kevin.
Jean Cecil is here. She is the executive director of the Rachel Carson Homestead in Springdale. We are recording live here at the house, the actual house where Rachel Carson was born and grew up in for a while. She lived here for how long?
For the first 22 years of her life.
That's exciting to be here. I've never been here before. So we are excited to hear all about Rachel Carson's homestead.
A lot of people are surprised to find out that it is here. She lived here through the time that she went to college, and then she moved to Baltimore, and the family eventually followed her. From there, she also lived in the Washington, D.C. area and other places, but she spent the most significant portion of her life here.
So, Jean, before we get into talk about the house here and your role as executive director, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm passionate about Rachel Carson. Back when I was in high school, that's when the environmental movement first started to... there was first public awareness about environment and ecology. And then I went off and I had a mentor who came here. And it's interesting because she was someone who, she had been a biology teacher, and then she was promoted to administration and environmental education. And then she came here. By that time, I went off to college, and she remained involved here. So she knew the people who founded the Homestead Association, the Rachel Carson Homestead Association. And back then, I didn't have a good perspective to know how big Rachel Carson was. I knew she was big, but I didn't know, you know, her world stature. So eventually, I came back here. I had done a couple little community projects. I was involved with volunteering with a couple small nonprofits. Then when I came here, I came to volunteer and to re-engage myself with environmental awareness. So I came here with a very humble attitude that I could volunteer and help take care of things. At the time I came here, the house had just been through a portion of restoration. The front facade was restored, but the interior had been neglected and other portions were also. So previously there were donations that helped try to evoke how the family lived. And so they were removed during restoration and the house was kind of left empty.
So you came here primarily because you had a real passion for environmentalism, respect for Rachel Carson. You knew of her, you knew of her stature. And that's what drew you to this museum.
Right. I happened to move nearby to take care of my parents. My parents had moved here. And so once I got settled in, I thought that I could help out here. I took a tour, learned what needed to be done, and helped out. And then the board had been through transition. So we kind of rebuilt a board. And it was challenging because of the transitions. But my optimism came from the fact that Rachel Carson has international stature. It's amazing when you come here and people visit, they come from around the world. And Rachel Carson changed people's lives, not just, I mean, we know she changed the whole perspective on chemicals and pesticides and her whole environmental ethic. But individuals come here and say, you know, when they tell you their story of how she changed their lives, it's just very inspiring. Rachel Carson was born here in 1907. She grew up here and wanted to become an author, but she also enjoyed the outdoors. You know, her mother inspired her to that. So at the time Rachel started her career, started working, she was working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so she was privy to a lot of information from the government and industry and academia. Meanwhile, her own passion was about marine life and the oceans. I think a lot of people growing up in landlocked Pittsburgh kind of yearned for that, and she got to finally see the ocean. And so things kind of segued for her so well that she was able to take a work assignment and was encouraged to send it off to the Atlantic Monthly. Long story short, she became a famous author. In 1951, her book, The Sea Around Us, went to the bestseller list for 18 months. It was translated into 32 languages. So around the world, she was considered Jacques Cousteau before there was a Jacques Cousteau. And maybe a lot of people today don't even know who Jacques Cousteau was, but people had not gone underwater. They talked about the ocean. There were poets and, you know, novels about the ocean, but people hadn't experienced it firsthand. And Rachel, through her literary skill, she was able to bring that to the average person. So she wrote as a scientist. She had her master's degree in zoology, and she wrote accurately as a scientist, but she engaged people passionately about the ocean. So she had this credential. She, when her books went to the bestseller list, she kind of struggled before that. But then she was able to quit her job and become a full-time writer. She bought some property in Maine and built a little cottage, and she could have lived happily ever after, enjoying the beauty of nature. She wanted to write an anthology of biology. She wanted to expand on an editorial she wrote about nurturing your child's sense of wonder. That's very key to her ethos. And she collected information, and because she had this public name, other newspaper writers and people with environmental concerns wrote to her and said, hey, all this that we're hearing about DDT, how safe it is not really true. So backing up, DDT was a wonder chemical. It saved thousands of lives, I'm sure, during World War II because it killed mosquitoes. And so after World War II, industry shifted to say, we can control nature. You know, it was man against nature, and we're going to conquer these insects and we'll live happily ever after. We have a picture here in the house of a woman spraying DDT over her baby's crib. And I tell people that's, you know, she wasn't arrested. That's not from the National Enquirer. We were told it's a pesticide. It's going to kill pests and then go away. And that's what Rachel questioned. She had the courage to do that, to stick her neck on the line and say, this may not be accurate. We don't know everything. So one of her messages was, you know, a little bit of humility in the face of all the technology and the scientific knowledge we're gaining. The other message that she brought through her research and the evidence she collected was that nothing is in isolation. There's this interconnectedness. So Rachel Carson, from an environmental view, actually, the word environment was not used the way it is today. She brought that knowledge to us, that concept. So she really, you know, shifted the paradigm, and ecology was another word that was not in the public domain as much. It was, you know, purely academic. So she brought that awareness to us. So every time I see eco something or green something, I think people need to know that Rachel Carson started that. We had environmentalists and conservationists before her, but everybody for the most part, focused on what we would enjoy. We want to enjoy the wilderness and preserve the national parks so that we can enjoy them. Actually, you know, there was another environmentalist before her, Alda Leopold, brought the idea of community, but he didn't, he had more of an academic audience. Rachel Carson, with her worldwide stature and writing for people, for the average person, she was able to bring that concept of stewardship kind of back, you know, full circle to Native Americans who said, wait, we're just living here. You know, we aren't going to conquer nature because we're part of it.
Right, right. So Rachel's seminal book, Silent Spring, you know, which really takes up the question of DDT and the environment, it not only raised alarms, but it really motivated people around those alarms. I mean, it inspired people.
It did inspire people. Silent Spring was published in 1962, and Rachel Carson died in 64. So she wasn't around very long after but she was around long enough to see its success. But the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the establishment of the EPA, all those things, all that legislation is credited to her and in some circles blamed on her.
Yes, she came under a heavy attack by chemical industries. I mean, they were ruthless, weren't they, those attacks?
Right, right. They called her a hysterical woman, that she wasn't a real scientist because she didn't have a PhD. One man said, well, what does she care about genetics? Because, you know, she's a spinster. Just all kinds of things that were these accusations. But the more you know about her, the more courageous you know she was. As I said, she could have lived, you know, peacefully, but she was driven by her conscience. When she collected the facts about DDT and other synthetic chemicals, she said, there would be no peace for me if I kept silent. So she really felt an obligation to her conscience to write the book.
Certainly. Well, you know, with the work that we do, with local history, we always like to say that it's important for us to educate, entertain, and inspire the public, you know, around history. And Rachel Carson certainly did that. Her books are wonderfully written. So that's the entertaining part. But she certainly educated and inspired people around environmental issues. How do you fulfill that here at the Rachel Carson Homestead? You are an educational center.
That's a perfect way of framing our mission. Our mission here is to preserve, restore, and maintain the homestead, and also to educate about Rachel Carson, her environmental ethic, and inspire by her sense of wonder. And that phrase, sense of wonder, is very important for Rachel Carson. The magazine article I referred to that she wrote and wanted to develop into another book was called Nurturing Your Child's Sense of Wonder. And I was at a program where someone asked me, or was talking about how to develop environmental activists. Where's the next generation going to come from? And in Rachel Carson's mind, the first thing you do is observe. So you slow down enough to observe something, and from that you are inspired to learn more. That sense of wonder, that sense of curiosity will drive you to want to learn. And the more you learn, then you start caring for things. So that was her philosophy. And it's amazing, I ran into someone, a famous ornithologist, who actually knew Rachel Carson. She mentored him, but he was a little boy and he met her through Audubon bird outings, and he said she was the only adult who was more concerned about me truly enjoying nature rather than trying to teach me things.
Oh, wow.
Another piece of evidence about her, that being so important to her, was that a woman from Monroeville came in with two adult daughters, and she introduced herself as Rachel Carson's cousin, which was rare. And anyway, long story short, we started talking, and she showed me a book. Rachel's books were written in children's editions as well. And she said she remembers Rachel visiting in the 50s. She said everybody else was, you know, women wore house dresses back then, but Rachel came in with a suit, cherry red fingernail polish. She was always very proper. And in her book, she inscribed it, "To my youngest cousin, wherever you go, whether in your backyard, the fields, or the shore, may your sense of wonder remain with you." And she signed it, "Your cousin, Rachel." And this woman said, yeah, every summer she would send me a bunch of seashells in a little box, perfectly labeled and lined in cotton. And then she said, they must be in the basement somewhere, but, you know, I'll have to find them someday. So that takes us back to here, and we'd like to educate about her and have some of the few artifacts we have of Rachel's childhood writings and other notes here on display so people can see them and appreciate how important that was to her.
And I think that this is her childhood home. This is where it all began. It really does fit, at least symbolically, it does fit into the whole mission of a childlike wonderment of the world.
Right, right. She has the most beautiful quotes. I think one of them is very similar to something, I think it was from Einstein, that, you know, talking about our humility, the more you learn, the more humility you gain because of, you realize how ignorant we are and how wonderful the world is. Coming back to the house, there are people who come in here who know of Rachel Carson and are just so thrilled. One woman, the director of Sweden's public radio, came in, and when she saw the portrait was on the mantle, she just glowed and walked through the house, and you could tell she was like visiting a shrine. Another group came in, and there are people who don't know anything about Rachel Carson. So don't be intimidated. You don't need to be an environmentalist or, you know, educated historian to know about, to want to see this house.
So there are no prerequisites.
No prerequisites. We start with what do you know about her, or what do you want to know about her? And we had a group come in, a couple from Chicago who had read everything about her, and we just sat here most of the time and had a more of a philosophical discussion. Another Saturday, a woman came in and she said, I don't know anything about her, but Pittsburgh named a bridge after her, so she must be important.
Oh, there
so
you
we
go.
Started there. Another time we had a group of a class reunion was taking some field trips, and they came here, and a couple people suggested this site, and a couple others were just like, the whole time they were muttering, why didn't I know anything about her? Why didn't we ever learn about her? There's so many things you can learn from her life. And in fact, there's now a Girl Scout cadet badge on walking in Rachel Carson's steps and Rachel Carson's legacy. The fact that she was one person who could speak up and change the world. Her editor, Paul Brooks, wrote a few thousand words from her and the world changed.
Mm.
The whole view changed.
Wow. This is such significant history, you know, in the broadest sense, internationally known. Today, we're still feeling the effects of her work. Let's bring this down even more to the homestead here, right here in Springdale, Pennsylvania. I'm sure a lot of people have never heard of Springdale, situated right on the Allegheny River upstream from downtown Pittsburgh, probably, what, 15 miles
yes,
or so we
about
are?
About 15, yep.
One of the things that I think is so important about local history is that you can get so up close and up front with this history. You know, here we are. We're sitting in the house. It's a comfortable house. You're explaining that people come here can have a chance to sit down and talk with you all here, the staff here, about Rachel Carson. You can't do this at large museums and large historical sites. You just can't do that. This is so intimate here. And this is just really, to me, the epitome of local history. What does it take to keep this site going?
Well, you use the word staff. We don't actually have staff. And even though I'm given the title executive director, I volunteer here. I work on a full-time job and I volunteer here in my spare time.
We have docents, right? You have
everybody who is on the board rotates as docents. We would welcome additional docents. I've reached out to some of the local high schools. We've had college groups come through here. We're looking for people to volunteer who want to be docents. The house is not intimidating. It's only four full rooms, and you don't need to make a major commitment of time to be involved. You know, helping one Saturday a month for 2 months is a bigger help than you think.
Do you have a lot of support from the local community for the house?
Someone just said to me, oh yeah, I hear you're doing great things there. Last year, we got a new roof on the house. That was long overdue. Someone called and said, I want to help. She said, I want to buy you a new roof. Well, this woman ended up initiating and helping to do most of the fundraising to build this. We haven't named it yet. We've got this it's too nice to be a shed, but we're calling it a classroom in the back property so we can have groups meet there, larger groups.
And you have pathways up behind the property here,
right.
Like a nature trail,
I see. The house sits on about a half an acre, but the school property is just above us. And so there's a strip of land across the top of this hill, and that's school property, but we maintain a trail there. All that was Carson property at one point.
And I just have to explain to our listeners, those who've never been here, that this house sits in a community of Springdale. I mean, there are houses on either side. It's sort of like Elvis's birthplace in Tupelo. I mean, it just sits amongst other houses in a neighborhood, And this is the same situation here. There's a school up top of the hill, houses on the left and right. It's on a, you know, your average kind of street, you know.
You could pass it by if you weren't looking for it.
Yes, it certainly looks older than the other homes
right.
around here. Tell us a little bit about some of the events that you have here throughout the year or activities that you have, environmental activities, educational activities, as well as activities that help support the homestead.
What we're doing is having the house open for tours and welcoming people here. And we also, we're open on Saturdays, but also by appointment. That helps fulfill our mission of education. Most of the other education is driven by the audience. So when scouts want to come here, they contact us. We have families who come here because their children are working on National History Day projects and other people who just want to visit garden clubs, historical societies, and that. So doing that for a small group of volunteers is, and taking care of the house is pretty substantial. But the events that we have resurrected sort of include Rachel's birthday. We celebrate that on the weekend of Memorial Day. Rachel's birthday was May 27th. So that weekend, we usually have a speaker or some other entertainment. We are not large enough yet to compete with other events for Earth Day, but that traditionally had been our grand opening, and we have had lectures here around that.
Oh, I would weekend. Think that would be just so key.
As far as Rachel's international stature, people are surprised to learn there's a Rachel Carson Institute at the University of Munich in Germany. Finland has a Rachel Carson Environmental Award. I'm told, and I haven't been to Baltimore in years, but you can't go anywhere without seeing Rachel Carson somewhere there because she went to school there. She went to Johns Hopkins and lived there. So, yeah, people want to claim her. You know, Pittsburgh named a bridge after her, but this house offers some authenticity. There's a little spring house down below. It looks the same as it did in the pictures from Rachel's time. And that's where the Carson family got their water. This house, when they lived here, they didn't intend to improve it. People were surprised to learn this. Rachel's father actually bought the 65 acres here to sell off and make some money so that he could build a modern home for his family. So the whole time they lived here, I think in the last few years they got some electricity, but they didn't have electricity. They didn't have indoor plumbing or central heating. Even when Rachel went to school to the Pennsylvania College for Women, her friends were surprised that they'd still lived like that. One girl exclaimed that Rachel's mother was very gracious, but I'm shocked they still didn't have indoor plumbing. I'm sure that was...
This was a real person who grew up in a little town here along the Allegheny River, little frame house.
Yeah, to me, I use the analogy of Lincoln's Log Cabin. It's like finding Lincoln's Log Cabin in your backyard. Because like Lincoln, Rachel had a major impact on our history. She had an international stature, we've said that. But also the humility that she grew up in a humble home. They weren't wealthy. Her parents tried to be successful financially. Circumstances didn't really allow that. And that helped the house retain its character, the original part. A teacher bought the house after the Carsons left here, and she made these additions. And so we can thank her for recording some of what the house was like at the time she purchased it in the
30s. Through photographs and things like that.
Through some photographs, but more from, she was an English teacher, so she loved to write, and she actually wrote stories about it. And for example, she knew there's a piano here that this is the kind of piano that Rachel's mother had, and she taught on it and gave music lessons to help supplement the family income.
And I think people would love to know that we do have indoor plumbing here now.
Yes, we do.
That's a good thing.
Yes, we do. We have indoor plumbing, and we've actually rented out this room that we're sitting in, this meeting room. It's not very large, but we've used a couple rooms. Someone recently had a wedding shower here.
Oh, really?
A young woman who was getting married was going to begin a program in some type of sustainability, and her mother-in-law thought, well, where better to visit than the Rachel Carson homestead, and they set up here. Everyone who comes here and wants to help us comes up with ideas, and we're open to everything. So, for example, we were going to have a fly tying session here. Someone said,
like a fishing.
Yeah. Oh. He said, I we could bring people to do that. And I was surprised the person who presented started out introducing Rachel Carson and how important clean water is for trout fishing. You can't have trout without clean water. And, you know, he went through a little bit of the history of our local streams and why we now can fish here and in Erie, where, you know, a few decades ago, you had to go spend thousands of dollars to go to the Northwest to be able to fish for steelhead. I mean, that's just one little example, but Rachel Carson was so savvy. She worked for the government, so she had an audience with hunters and fishermen. She, one of her series that she worked on was called Conservation in Action. So, you know, she had the hunters and fishermen. They knew R.L. Carson. And then she belonged to the Audubon Society. She was with the birding organizations in the Washington area. Garden Club people are surprisingly very aware of the impact of herbicides and pesticides and all this. And so that was another audience. She also was engaged with journalists. So I think people need to learn history. We always use those cliches that we're not reinventing the wheel and we need to learn from the past. I think one of Rachel Carson's messages was that, you know, we're at a crossroads, sort of. And the whole point of Silent Spring is it could be silent someday. We now see the, you know, decimation of pollinators. And I was going to add one other thing about why this place is so important.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
And that's when Rachel Carson was closing her cottage in Maine, she knew she was dying. And she wrote to a friend that morning. This was in the, I guess, early 60s. They had just had a wonderful little walk. And she said, thank you for the wonderful morning, but most of all, I shall remember the monarchs. And she said, they were migrating and there were tons of them. And she said, back then they didn't know where they went. And she said, we said that we didn't know if they returned. We thought not, but we didn't mourn for them because the life cycle was a natural and beautiful thing. But what she was saying was telling her friend not to mourn for her. And that reflects back to one of her, a beautiful quote from her in the, that's repeated in a couple different sources, but that those who contemplate the beauty of nature find strengths of reserve that shall carry them through life. As soon as her publisher said they were going to publish Silent Spring, lawsuits poured in against her publisher, and she bore through all that. Her family life, there were difficulties, to say the least, that she wanted to keep quiet. And she struggled with all this. She struggled with fame from her books because she was a private person. And so that strength of reserve that carried her through is what she developed here as a young child. You know, walking in the woods and observing and getting that connection.
So this is where it all
began. This is where it began.
I grew up in the forest and the wild things. When I was just a lad of 12, I read a book called Silent Spring. Even through the eyes of a child, that wisdom it rang true. We're all part of this web of life, that's what it all comes down to. I'm singing this song for Rachel and for the others of my tribe. I'm singing it.
Hey, Jeannie, what's this music we're listening to here? What is this song?
Hey, this is called A Song for Rachel. There was a man named Walkin' Jim Stoltz, and he walked across the country. And it's funny because I was just reading Bill McKibben's Wandering Home about, you know, between the Adirondacks in New York and Vermont. And he quotes Jim Stoltz saying, how good life would be if we could all be more conscious of where things come from, if we could turn away from blind consumption and live with more awareness of the life around us. Jim starts out this song with, I grew up in love with the forest and the wild things. When I was just a lad of 12, I read a book called Silent Spring. And even though through the eyes of a child, that wisdom it rang true, we're all part of this web of life, and that's what it all comes down to. There will be no Silent Spring, and there will come a better day if we keep singing the song for Rachel and remember what she had to say.
We're all drinking from the same well, sustained by the same old sun.
So he uses that term web of life, and that's one of Rachel's greatest contributions to us, that everything is interconnected. And really remembering what she had to say is so important because in that same album, which we, by the way, we sell in our gift shop, there's a Rachel Carson addressing the National Women's Press Conference 3 months after Silent Spring was published. And she goes through the list of accusations about her, including that she is a bird lover, a tree lover, a cat lover, all this stuff, and a devotee of the laws of nature to which my critics must think they're immune. So that's her quiet humor. But as we get more removed, as our lives become more virtual, we forget that there are laws of nature and we can't change those results.
What amazing history here. And there's a website, rachelcarsonhomestead.org. And you're also on Facebook, search Rachel Carson Homestead Association. You'll find the organization there. Your phone number, 724-274-5459. But I want to thank you, Jeannie, for sharing so much of this history with us, being the representative of Rachel Carson Homestead here. We hope that this is a beginning for people to have a relationship with this wonderful local historical site here in Western Pennsylvania.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for hosting us. I agree with you that, you know, this history is so important because without it, the historical aspect would be lost, but we just need to continue this legacy. And I invite people to all join us and make it part of their legacy. You know, invite your friends to become members or pitch in $5 or come and visit the house if you can. It all adds up.
Thank you so much, Jean.
Thank you. To understand Rachel Carson's stature, there was a Time magazine cover, The 100 Most Influential People of the Century. And I think number 3 or 4 in this series was The Greatest Thinkers. So they had this cover with 5 people on it. And most people would recognize there's Freud sitting there with his notepad, and Einstein is lying down on the sofa, you know, thinking, and Keynes, the British economist, and Jonas Salk. And the 5th one is the only woman, and that was Rachel Carson. So she is up there. So sometimes, you know, if kids come here and I ask them to think of the most famous people they know, Rachel Carson should be one of those.
You are listening to a production of the Social Voice Podcast Network.